moment in time. But of course, there are still big divisions within Europe. Different countries have very different takes. So she also acknowledged that some people will think she's not going far enough, and some people will think she's gone too far.
Why do you think it is that we do see so much division in the EU on the subject of Israel?
I think we have to look at two dimensions. I mean, firstly, it is normal that there are these divisions. We have 27 different countries which have very different foreign policy stances, and we shouldn't forget that foreign policy is not one of the main areas of European coordination. Every country has their own policy and has also differing opinions on particularly issues which are as intractable as the Middle East, where for a very long time there hasn't really been a convincing solution on the table. But the other element, and that also has to do with how the European Union is set up, even those countries which might agree with the Commission President or with other parts of the European institutions very often object to the European Union becoming involved in these discussions because they don't see that this is a role for the European level to have a foreign policy stance.
Yeah, but we see the EU is now preparing its 19th round of sanctions, tough sanctions against Russia, and yet no sanctions so far against Israel. Like, why do you think that is? Is it the argument that, you know, Ukraine is in Europe, or is it the fact some people talk about the very powerful Israel lobby that has an influence over the decisions that are taken here?
I would actually argue that Russia is the exception. It normally is difficult to get agreement between the member states when it comes to foreign policy issues. Just having seen, for example, the incursion into Polish airspace very much highlights that this is something which affects all of us. So in that area, it is much, much easier to get consensus to move forward. Yes, there will be one or two countries which object, one or two governments which object, because they always object. But in principle, there's a vast majority which supports that action. When it comes to Israel, when it comes to other parts of the world, there are far greater divisions. In part, that also has to do with history, and the specific history of some countries with the countries involved, but more generally, it's just more difficult to get agreement, as we also see, for example, when it comes to China.
Well, the day before Ursula von der Leyen delivered the State of the Union address, there was a debate in the European Parliament on the situation in Gaza. And what you see there is a big chunk of the MEPs, the members of the European Parliament, the EU lawmakers, they are very far right. They support Netanyahu. They're very far right in their views. Why do you think it is that we're seeing the rise of the far right in the EU?
It is a long-term trend. We have seen the far right strengthening over time. In many ways, these are anti-parties. They don't really have solutions. They don't have programs. But they know what they are against, which is also a feature of how democratic discourse is developing. It's much easier now on social media to just simply be against certain issues and to get coalitions together which can block things. I think what we have seen in the United States is also a phenomenon over here. And we shouldn't underestimate how much the developments in the States will also fuel some of those divisions within Europe. Clearly, there are a number of far-right organizations which refer to Trump, which think that the Trumpian agenda is exactly what is needed. And I think we are going to see that it very much mixes with some of the big topics. I mean, clearly, migration has always been one of the breeding grounds for the far right. But we're also seeing increasingly it's about climate change and the measures which are there. It is about the war and supporting Ukraine, very often couched in terms of even if this is something which needs to be done. We shouldn't be the ones who are paying for it.
And Fabian, another thing that Ursula von der Leyen mentioned in her State of the Union address is in relation to the cost of living crisis. I mean, prices are so high here in the EU for rents, for food. You know, we've just seen a massive price increase over the last few years. Do you think, we mentioned the far right earlier, do you think that is why that could lead to a further expansion and rise of the far right?
I mean, certainly we live in much more challenging times. That's economically, that's socially. We are now in a period where for the first time really in European integration history, there's a realistic chance that the next generations are going to be worse off than current ones. And that creates a lot of political problems. In many areas, we now have to distribute costs. It's not about the benefits from working together, but it's actually about saying, how do we pay for defense? How do we pay for the green transition? How do we pay for all the different areas where we need to invest in the next few years? So it's a much more difficult political environment. And yes, many people are feeling that their life is getting worse, that they are not as secure, as stable, that they see prices rising. But the difficulty is that many of these are trends which are beyond the control of our governments or of the European Union. And the right-wing populists promise a lot, but there is no way they can fulfill these promises. And it's interesting, we've seen it with the example of Brexit, we've seen it now starting with the example of Trump. These promises do not lead to better outcomes for their population. In fact, they lead to worse outcomes, but it's very hard to counter them before they get into power.
Can I ask you as well about EU-US relations? Because obviously there's been a lot of tensions on issues like trade since Trump came back to the White House. How would you assess at the moment? There are differences on foreign policy. There are obviously issues in relation to trade and what else could happen, we don't know. But how would you assess relations at the moment between the United States and the European Union?
Relations between, I would say, the White House and the European Union are very bad. In many ways, Trump is opposed to the concept of the European Union. He doesn't like multilateralism. He doesn't like cooperation between states. He believes in a world where power matters. And if you are stronger, you can do whatever you want. He doesn't care about allies. He cares about who he sees as important people. So it is about people like Putin, and it is about those who fawn over him, who suggest that he will get the Nobel Prize, and so on. So this is anathema to how Europe works. It is a real threat to our democracy, because of course there are influences of that on our debates, on our parties. But in the background is always this dependence of Europe on security as well. And that's why we also had to accept a deal, which is a very bad deal for Europe, but there were only bad choices on the table.
And when you say a bad deal for Europe, do you think that the European Commission, the institutions, the EU leaders could have pushed back harder against Trump on this issue?
Of course, we had the choice to push back harder. The question is, what would the consequences be of that? And we have already seen that Trump is very willing to put security on the table as well. And that is a risk which Europe at the moment cannot run, because we are too dependent on the United States, and Ukraine is too dependent on the United States. So what we had to accept in the end comes directly out of our weakness.
Can we afford more military spending in the European Union? We do have, if you look at the Eurostat data, we have a huge number of people at risk of poverty or in poverty. We've had, you know, increased spending in NATO, and most of the NATO members are also members of the EU. in terms of the countries, and then additionally more military spending within the EU itself. So billions upon billions being spent on weapons, and people argue not enough on social justice. So can we afford all this military spending?
I think we don't have a choice. There are imperatives which we have to fulfill, and defense has to be one of the key areas which we spend money on. And it is an area where also you will need a lot of public money. It is not something where you can rely on the private sector. But then I think it is also a question of seeing what is it actually we are spending on. There is a lot of money in the 5% target, which is also about infrastructure. It's about developing what will also help the private economy. It's not only about military. I would also argue that we can benefit a lot from this additional spending in the defense sector if we think about it in the right way, if we coordinate in Europe, if we don't buy all of these weapons from elsewhere. I think there are many things which we can do. But in the end, it's also not only about amounts of money. It's not about the figure which we are going to put in the end to convince Trump that we have done what we said we would do. It's about how well we are spending it. And I think this is the biggest challenge we have in Europe. When we look at how much we collectively spend, it is vastly more than Russia. But we are not very effective in how we spend it. So we need to find ways of getting better at spending that money, and that also means doing more things together. One of the big challenges, and I think that goes right through the State of the Union in almost every policy area, is that we now live in a world where the need to work together at the European level is greater than ever. Many of the challenges will not be addressed unless we do it together. But the political reluctance to really work together, to put competences at the European level, is greater than ever. So we have a paradox.
Can I ask you as well, you know, one of the big policy achievements of the European Union was to create the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA nuclear deal with Iran. And Trump in his first term tore that up. Now we don't know where we stand in terms of diplomacy and nuclear talks with Iran. Is there any hope of resurrecting the JCPOA in your opinion, or creating a new accord? What are your feelings, or what are your thoughts on that?
Certainly, the deal with Iran was groundbreaking, and it was very much Europeans in the driving seat, working out what could be done. But it was already very much damaged after Trump tore it up in his first presidency. And now with the attacks on Iran by Israel, it's very hard to see also what the Iranian side is going to do. Clearly, there was a decision taken, I would argue, not only in Israel, but also in Washington, that military force would be more effective. Now it remains to be seen whether that's true, whether this has really damaged Iranian capabilities in the long run. It has increased the volatility, but we can't just go back to the old deal. That time has passed forever.
And in your view, could the EU side have done more to save the JCPOA nuclear accord? Could they be doing more now diplomatically in terms of trying to secure a new agreement?
It seems to be that at this moment in time, some of the key actors within the Middle East are entirely ignoring Europe. So if the United States, if Israel do not listen, it's very hard to see how Europe could play a broker role, because clearly you would have to have also concessions from those countries. So at the moment, I think it is very difficult to see any way forward. And I would actually argue that what we have seen over the last month is a significant deterioration in the Middle East, which will destabilize for a long time to come, because even long-standing issues like the two-state solution for Palestine is looking even further away than it did before.
Do you think there's any hope of a two-state solution at this stage?
At this stage, no. At this stage, there is no willingness to even start negotiating. But I would also say that all the actions which are being taken now are running counter to the idea of a two-state solution. So it's very hard to see how we will even return to the status quo before all of these attacks.
Yeah. And do you think that, like, even with the recent attack on Qatar, an independent sovereign state, and we saw the attack by Israel on Iran, and the United States also attacking Iran, but in terms of Israel's position, do you feel there's a move away from Israel and the EU, given that we've seen an escalation and attacks on sovereign countries? I know he has a lot, Benjamin Netanyahu and the government have a lot of support, for example, in the European Parliament with the far right. But generally speaking, at government level, EU institution level, is there a move away from Netanyahu?
I think what we've seen also in the reaction to the bombing in Qatar is that this is breaking the kind of guardrails which for many countries are just a step too far. Will that change his behavior? Well, that really depends on the big supporter. It depends on the United States. And there the question is whether, yes, we've seen a bit of condemnation, but whether that condemnation will actually be followed with concrete steps or whether it simply is talk. Unfortunately, my guess would be that Trump is not willing to do anything decisive, which means that Benjamin Netanyahu will just continue doing what he's doing.
More generally speaking, Fabian, can I ask you about what you see the future of the European Union being? I mean, the euro area is expanding shortly. In January, Bulgaria will join the euro. There are many countries that want to join the European Union, full stop, and they'll automatically join the euro in that case. But is there a danger that the EU could expand too quickly to bring in countries that might turn against the project in the long run, as we might have seen here at the moment, for example, perhaps with Hungary and a couple of others? So in terms of the future of the EU, what are your thoughts on that?
I think we should be very careful that we're not nostalgic about the European Union and what it might have been in the past. Because the reality is that we are seeing challenges also in the member states, which were there from the beginning. What will happen, for example, if we have a far-right French president, which I would say is a very realistic possibility at this moment in time. We see that far-right parties, anti-European parties, are strong in the polls in Germany. This is something where I think we have to be very careful not to paint a too idealistic picture of what the current EU is like. We have to bring in the countries which are waiting. Enlargement should not be something which is even in question, because the geopolitics, the geoeconomics mean that we have to bring these in. If we do not bring in Ukraine, it will not be safe, which has implications for all of us. If we do not bring in the Western Balkans, other countries will step in and will dominate politics there. So we have to do it, but what we have to do at the same time is also make the reforms necessary to make a union function with 30-plus members. And that's where we didn't see anything in the State of the Union. There was no realistic idea of how do we actually move from the Union as it is now to the one which we need to have to address the challenges, including also bringing in the countries which are waiting to come in.
And is that a failure in terms of her vision, Ursula von der Leyen's vision, or is she just merely peddling the views of and the feelings and the stance of the EU leaders and the EU institutions, or is it a personal failure in terms of having the foresight on her part?
I would argue both. Yes, she is reflecting where the debate is on enlargement and reform. But it is also a question of her not putting forward a stronger vision, not putting forward concrete steps to say this is what we should be doing next. But clearly the blame does not only lie with the Commission President or with the institutions. The key question here is how willing are our governments to do the policy changes which are necessary to address the fundamental challenges which we all have, but which are difficult and at times politically costly.
Fabian Zuleg, CEO of the European Policy Centre, thank you very much for your time today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Earth and the heavens begin to sing. The angels celebrate the birth of a king. A king who outshines the stars of the night. A beacon of hope. You guide us with your quenches the thirst of every broken heart. A piece of paradise in this desert land. Oh yeah, with grace and kindness you fill our empty blessings of God upon you is my prayer. The earth and the heavens begin to sing. This day we celebrate the birth of a king.
Good night to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start off this hour's lineup with Islamic laws. The program focuses on Islamic Sharia law and adopts a practical approach. After that, we have insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis and explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. And our final program this hour is Leader's Speech. The program presents an English translation of a selection of the statements and speeches of the Honorable Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Stay with us for the next hour.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein, this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back in the studio, shedding light on some of the questions and answers here related to the Islamic laws according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And we are supposed to actually, talk about some of these laws, of miscellaneous nature, of course. Let me begin this episode with this question. If at the time of the last tashahhud of the imam, prayer leader, basically,
yes,
the congregant is in the first or third rak'ah, is tajafi obligatory? What should we say while translating?
Well, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tajafi, meaning resting on the toes with knees raised while leaning to the right. Resting on the toes with knees raised and leaning to the right a little bit is not obligatory during the tashahud of the imam. When the imam is busy doing tashahud or even going performing, completing the namaz, it's not necessary for the person joining or attending the congregational prayer to be seated in that position, in the position of tajafi. Rather, the follower should maybe rise and continue his prayer to complete the remaining rak'ah. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, says that it is recommended, it is mustahab, to remain seated in the position of tajafi. While the imam is reciting the tashahud, it is recommended. And in this case, the follower should recite the tashahud along with the imam. Okay, he can recite the tashahud along with the imam, but he is not required to recite the salam, okay? Because otherwise, it will complete
end the
prayer.
Yes.
So this way, the spiritual etiquette of following the imam is observed without disrupting the order of the individual's prayer. The individual's prayer is maintained, and the shape of the prayer, the form of the prayer is observed.
Mm-hmm. Does it have to be like in that special position that you described? I've seen it actually, many congregants do this in the first or third rak'ah while they are offering their prayer. And the imam is, in fact, on the tashahud, basically, right? So they would, stay in a very special position, something similar to a squatting situation, basically. So is that recommended?
It is recommended.
I see.
Yes, that is the position. You just put you know, you just rest on the toes and your knees are not touching the ground.
Yes, they're a little bit high above the ground, right?
Yes.
So if they, you know, assume the position of the tashahhud, would it be wrong?
It's not wrong. It's not, you know, it does not affect the prayer.
Uh-huh.
Yes. He will have to wait until, okay, the imam, if the imam is going to give salam, he's not going to say salam, okay?
Of course.
Yes, he will have to stand up.
They will continue the prayer.
Yes.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chawid. Let's, you know, take a break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
Followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
I'm Glaz on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, you know, some people are not able actually to perform Hajj due to any good reason. For example, physical incapability, basically,
yes,
right? You know, the question that was raised in that regard is like, my mother, somebody asked, has performed Hajj on behalf of my grandmother. Does this Hajj on behalf replace the obligatory Hajj of my mother? Or must she perform Hajj again for herself when she's able to do so?
Right. Oh, I think the answer is very clear. When someone is not capable of performing the obligatory Hajj because of certain reason, and mainly because of financial issues, problems, and she or maybe he or someone, anyone, wants to represent another person, that person is supposed to give, provide for the expenses of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, she or he can perform Hajj on behalf of anyone, maybe the mother, the grandmother, or anyone else, anyone. So it's okay. But if the individual himself is has the means and the wealth, the ability to perform Hajj, she cannot represent another person. She must perform Hajj on her own behalf, and I mean she must perform her own Hajj, mm-hmm. which is wajib on her. And then after she does it, of course, in the following years, she can take action to perform Hajj on behalf of anyone, including the grandmother or the grandfather, anyone else. So the question I think I suppose you asked is, of course, it depends on whether she is financially and bodily capable or not. If she is, she must perform Hajj after she... Okay, maybe in the time when she performed Hajj on behalf of her grandmother, right?
Mm-hmm.
She was not financially capable to perform her own Hajj. But later on, maybe after a few years, she started to create or build some kind of asset. And then she found herself in a position to go to Hajj, of course she must take action for Hajj because she is now
capable.
Yes.
But can anyone, in fact, or any individual, you know, have both intentions?
No.
Like, for example, you do like your own obligatory Hajj if you are capable to do it, of course, or you have enough assets as you just mentioned, along with the Hajj on behalf.
No, it's not permissible to do any act of worship, whether it's prayer, whether it's Hajj, or whether it's fasting, to perform a single duty, religious duty on behalf
with two intentions.
Yeah, with two intentions. Yes, that's not permissible.
Uh-huh.
Yes, you cannot do it.
Uh-huh, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's have a break, another break, and then we'll come back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked us, I went out of town for recreation, for fun.
Yes.
I found a ring on the way and picked it up. So, what is his or her duty?
Right. The ruling depends on the value of the item he found, okay? Depending on how much valuable it is. So, the situation differs from time to time depending on the value of the item found, right? If the value of the ring is less than the price of 2.5 grams of silver, then he must keep it, and of course he can keep it, he may keep it,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes his
property,
yes. And there's no need for just for going around and announcing,
mm-hmm.
because it's, you know, it's not worth announcing. It's 2.5 grams of silver, right? So it's very important, because normally we for example, walk along the street and we all of a sudden we find something, so we have to see whether it is really worth 2.5 gram or more than that. If it's more than that, then the ruling and it differs. Otherwise, you can pick it up for yourself and use it. Okay. Then, if the value is more than that amount, I would like to make it clear, then he is required to announce it publicly for 1 year.
Oh.
1 year. This is the most difficult part of the obligation, because if you have to announce it for 1 year, keep announcing it, and make it wherever possible, whether on the cyberspace or in public places.
In the press. Yes.
Make announcement. It's necessary for her to do. Otherwise, he cannot take it or use it for himself or give it to someone else on behalf of the...
As a charity.
As charity on behalf of the actual owner.
Yes.
So, okay. If the owner turns up and claims it, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
He can, after he gives the signs, and actually he can give it
back.
Okay, back
return
to him
the property. Yes.
But if after one year no owner claims it and comes forward to ask for, then of course he can keep it for himself. He can give it in charity on behalf of the owner. Or he can keep it with himself while still searching for the owner. This is the third choice.
A very quick question. We don't have much time, Sheikh Javid. If quite related to this question, of course. We just ignore it and we don't pick it up.
Right.
Would it be actually an ethical and religious duty, basically?
I think it is safer. It is safer to not to pick it up.
Uh-huh.
Yes, because you know...
Is it okay? Is it permissible to do it?
Why not?
Like to give it a shout out?
For example, you okay, I should also mention this. Depending on whether you live in an Islamic country or in a non-Islamic country, so that ruling also differs, okay?
Mm.
If you find something in an Islamic country, you can choose not to pick it up.
Right.
Pick it up. Because if you pick it up, there's the headache comes after it.
Yes.
You will have to announce it. But if you are in a non-Muslim country and there is nothing to indicate that thing which you have found belongs to a Muslim, you can pick it for yourself, even if it belongs you can pick it and use it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You just, even if it's if it's more than 2.5 grams.
I see.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Javid.
Yeah.
Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you, and in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of Surah Al-Ankabut, or Chapter Spider, the 29th chapter of the Holy Quran. So, dear listeners, as you have been with us previously, we have reached the 10th verse of Surah Ankabut. So, before we start our discussion regarding this verse, let's listen to the verse under discussion.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Wa minan nasi man yaqulu amanna billahi fa idha في الله جعل فتنة الناس كعذاب الله فإذا أوذي
في الله جعل فتنة الناس كعذاب الله ولئن جاء نصر من ربك ليقولن إنا كنا معكم أوليس الله بأعلم بما في صدور العالمين.
And of the people are some who say, we believe in Allah. But when one of them is harmed for the cause of Allah, they consider the trial of the people as if it were the punishment of Allah. But if victory comes from your Lord, they say, indeed, we were with you. Is not Allah most knowing of what is within the breasts of all creatures?
So, in view of the fact that there were mentioned some explicit statements about the righteous believers in two or three of the previous verses, and also the statements about polytheism and polytheists were mentioned in the former verses, in this verse, the words are about a third group, which is hypocrites. So the verse says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ أَمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ. And among the people, there are some of them who say, we believe in Allah. فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. And when they are hurt in Allah's cause, they think the persecution of men as it were Allah's chastisement. وَلَئِنْ جَاءَ نَصْرٌ مِّن رَبِّكَ. And if help comes from your Lord, لَيَقُولُنَّ إِنَّا كُنَّا مَعَكُمْ. They will surely and certainly say, verily we were with you. أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ. What? Is not Allah the best knower of what is in the breasts of mankind? So, this verse is implicitly saying that the expression of faith by some people is only oral, and it is not said by heart. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ أَمَنَّا. They only say that we believe in Allah. But the true faith will often be made manifest at the time of afflictions. فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. When they are hurt in Allah's cause, they think the persecution of men as if it were Allah's chastisement. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this regard, has said, the reality and essence of man will be known in the change of circumstances. So, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَقُولُ آمَنَّا. There are some people, among the people, are those who say, آمَنَّا. The Arabic word amanna, we believe, is used in the verse in plural form, while the next phrase is in singular, because it may be for the reason that this group of hypocrites want to be counted among the group of believers, so they say amanna, and they mean that they have believed like other people. So you see, these hypocrites are really careful, and they are actually doing really tricky stuff in the society of Muslims, and that's why the Muslims need to be aware.
عذاب الله.
as we were saying regarding this 10th verse of Surah Ankabut, these hypocrites are really careful in their manners in the society because they want to actually be considered with the other people of the society. So they say, Amanna. But فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ, when they are hurt in Allah's cause, this means that they are hurt in the way of Allah. This means they are sometimes hurt in the way of Allah and faith by their enemies. So it is interesting that when speaking about the punishment of Allah, the Quranic word adab is used. But when it speaks about people's hurts, it uses fitna and trial. جَعَلَ فِتْنَةَ النَّاسِ كَعَذَابِ اللَّهِ. And this indicates that people's hurts are not in fact punishments, but they are trials in order to be completed by men, in order to complete themselves. In this way, it teaches them that they might not compare those two with each other. And by the pretext that the opponents hurt and torture them, they leave out their faith, because this is a part of total program of trial in this world. So, before we move on, there arises a question here, that which victory had Allah bestowed on the Muslims in Mecca that hypocrites demanded to be part of it, that hypocrites demanded a share in it? The answer of it is that this sentence is a conditional sentence, and we know that a conditional sentence is not an evidence for the existence of the real condition happening actually, but its concept is that if there will be some victories for Muslims in future, these feeble faith hypocrites will demand share in it. Moreover, the Muslims gained some victories against enemies in Mecca, though they were not martial, and they were some victories in the fields of propagation or penetration in public thoughts, and the development of Islam amongst the different levels of people, but yet they demanded share in it. And the application of the word hurt, فَإِذَا أُوذِيَ فِي اللَّهِ, actually fits the environment of Mecca, else in the environment of Medina, such a thing rarely actually happened. But however, this point was also made clear that the term hypocrites is not only used for those who have never faith inwardly and do not express faith, but those feeble faith people who, under the pressure of this and that individuals, soon change their belief and are counted among hypocrites. And the holy verse under discussion apparently speaks of this kind of hypocrite and announces that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is aware of their intentions. أَوَلَيْسَ اللَّهُ بِأَعْلَمَ بِمَا فِي صُدُورِ الْعَالَمِينَ. Is Allah not the best knower of what is in the breasts of mankind? Thank you for staying with us in this episode as well. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
You can talk it down, turn the other way. Fear the truth, but it won't go away. Can you hear it calling? Yeah. You can write it down, but nobody
untold story of our biggest fears. It can reach you with no warning. Yeah, yeah. When the sun there's a part of me that won't understand, having sleepless nights with my head in my hands. I'm here and tears are falling, yeah. If I could right the wrongs, would you lend me your hand? I would make a difference to this beautiful land. If I'm nothing, I have my intention. When the sun goes down and there's nothing left around, can you feel it? Can you feel it? When your knees are on the ground, you may fear but it's allowed. Are you listening? 'Cause I need forgiving. I need forgiveness.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The birthday of Muhammad, peace be upon him and his progeny, marks the greatest celebration in history, 2016. Imam Khamenei. The resistance at the beginning of Bi'tha resulted in 3 years of unbelievable resistance in Shi'b Abi Talib. They lived in the sizzling sun in a valley near Mecca for 3 years. There were no plants and no water. And this is no joke. The Prophet ﷺ, Abi Talib, Khadija, and all Muslims and their families lived in this valley in the holes of the mountains. They had blocked all the ways so that they had no access to foodstuff. Sometimes when it was time for Hajj, in which, according to the rules of the ignorance era, no one was allowed to start a war, they were allowed to enter the town. But Abu Jahl, Abu Lahab, and other chiefs of Mecca had told their servants and children to pay twice the price and buy whatever the early Muslims needed to buy. They had been told to prevent Muslims from buying their requirements at a shop. It is no joke living in such difficult conditions for 3 years. It is such resistance and the heart that relies on Allah that gives rise to such solidity and makes people be patient. Children cried through the night out of hunger. The sound of their crying could be heard in Mecca, and some of the kind-hearted disbelievers of Quraysh felt sympathetic towards them.